Matthew chapter 16, verses 13 through 18. That's on page 950 in your pew Bible. And then from the book of John, chapter 18, verses 15 through 18, which is on page 1049, from the book of Matthew. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it."
John 18, verses 15 through 18. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. But Peter had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the girl on duty there, and brought Peter in. "Surely you are not another of this man's disciples," the girl at the door asked Peter. Peter replied, "I am not." It was cold, and the servants and officials stood around a fire they had made to keep warm. Peter also was standing with them, warming himself. The word of the Lord. Please be seated.
It was cold that night. The fire cut the bone chill of the damp air, but it could not cut the heart chill of my regret over the words that I had just spoken. The servant girl had whined, "Are you not one of him?" "I am not," I said. Twice more that sorry and beleaguered night, I would deny my earlier declaration about him. Twice more I would hate myself for the words which hoisted the flag of my cowardice. But I'm getting ahead of myself already. Thank you for coming this morning. Thank you for joining me in this cozy little tavern by the seaside here in Capernaum. Thank you for being my friends for many years, many of you. And of course, many of you I've known from the fishing business that we've shared together over these many years. Thank you for taking the time after a long night of fishing and drinking this hot, hearty tea with me and resting for just a bit. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Peter. My words were quickly spoken that night, and people tell me that I am very impulsive. But being impulsive is not as bad as you might think at first. You have to be impulsive to be a good fisherman. You have to know that your job is to get out there and in your boat and let down the nets and catch the fish. Fishing requires quick decisions. Now, Andrew, my brother, he is the more reflective and thoughtful type. He'll think long and hard about the best place to cast the nets. Now, don't get me wrong. We need that kind of person in business, too. But I don't know too many good fishermen who sit back and reflect for a whole long time on the meaning of catching fish. You just go catch them. So I'm not reluctant to say that I am the go-getter type. But Jesus let me have it now and then about being so quick on the draw. I admit, outside the garden, that day and that evening in Jerusalem when they came to get Jesus and I pulled my sword on that snotty high priest, I agree that cutting off his ear didn't help the cause of peace and harmony. And Jesus called me down pretty good on that one. And there was the time right after he had fed 5,000 men plus women and children and went off by himself to rest for a while. Remember, he told us to take the boat and go meet him on the other side of the lake. And then that squall came up. Now, I've grown up on the Sea of Galilee. And I've seen these storms come out of the mountains in the north and swoop down from the northeast into the lake. And they're gone as quickly as they come. So I didn't feel too worried. But you remember that night we saw Jesus walking toward us on the water in the midst of the storm. It was a little impulsive for me to ask him if I could walk with him out there on the water. And, well, you know my name Peter means rock, don't you? Well, that night I sank like one. Now, I know sometimes I think too little and I speak too quickly. Do you remember when Jesus took me and James and John up the hillside? He was going to pray, and I thought he was going to teach us a little bit about prayer. But this white light comes out of the sky, practically blinding me. And then Moses and Elijah appear as if out of nowhere. And Jesus was talking to them about what he was about ready to do in Jerusalem. Well, I should have kept my mouth shut. But, you know, sometimes you feel a little awkward being quiet. You just have to say something. And so I asked if they wanted me to put up a little tent for each one of them up there on the mountain. Maybe it was going to rain. I don't know. And maybe they needed a little protection. Well, I got put in my place pretty good. This voice comes out of heaven and tells me, quite personally and directly, to be quiet. Yes, I agree. I need to listen a little more and talk a little less. But sometimes, like I said, it's better to move quickly. You know, the first time I saw Jesus was right out here on the shore in Capernaum. Andrew and I were casting our nets for a shallow catch. The nets were heavy and I was tired. Maybe I didn't feel much like being a fisherman that day. And so when Jesus comes along and says, "Follow me," I didn't hesitate. I dropped my nets. I just followed right away. I didn't examine the syntax of his words. You know, when Jesus says, "Follow me," you don't deliberate. You follow. Like the time we were at a desolate spot with a group of about 4,000 people. Now, they had been there listening to Jesus teach for over 36 hours. And some of the other disciples, who were a lot more organized than I was, thought it would be good to organize a little picnic lunch for 4,000 people. Problem was, we didn't have anything to eat, but you know what happened. Jesus somehow took a little boy's lunch of 7 loaves and 2 fishes, and he made it into enough for everyone to eat. He's amazing, all right. And then there was the time that I had returned to fishing for a while. We were washing our nets one morning after a long night of not catching any fish at all. Jesus came walking along the shoreline with a huge crowd with him. In fact, there were so many people that he couldn't really get a vantage point from which to speak to them. So he asked if he could use one of my boats and push out just a little bit to give them a speech. Well, after he did that, he told me to take the boats out and cast the nets into the deep for a catch. Well, I tried telling him that we had worked all night and hadn't caught anything. I almost told him that he ought to stick to the preaching and let me do the fishing, but I thought better of it. And so I did what he told me to do, and I let down my nets. And within a minute and a half, there were more fish in my nets than they could hold, and they were breaking. You know, that was the first time that I really began to realize who Jesus was. Oh, sometimes I do jump to conclusions, I admit. But my first hunches about him were right. One time we went up to Caesarea Philippi, which is way up in the north. And we were having a little meeting up there, and some people were there. And Jesus said, "Who do the people say that I am?" He asked us, his followers, "Who do the people say that I am?" And some of the fellows said, "Well, they think you're John the Baptist, or they think you're Elijah, or they think you're Jeremiah, come back from the dead." But I told them flat out, he was the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God. And he told me that flesh and blood hadn't revealed that to me, that I couldn't figure that one out on my own, and that God had revealed it to me from the inside out. who he was. But I guess I didn't understand very much of what it meant for him to be the Christ. When he started saying that being the Messiah meant he was going to go to Jerusalem, be pushed around by the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, well, I couldn't stand the thought. And I told him so. And that's when he told me that the way up is the way down. If you want to save your life, you lose it. Well, maybe that's what he's done. He's gone to Jerusalem to lose his life. Maybe somehow it's going to be saved. You know, I guess that part of my impulsiveness is that I use the word never a lot. The problem is, I have to eat that word a lot too. I told him he would never have to suffer at the hands of the religious leaders in Jerusalem. I told him that he would never wash my feet as if he were some kind of servant. And I told him I would never deny him. You know, telling that bunch in the high priest's courtyard as I warmed my hands around the fire, telling them that I never knew him, well, I am a coward. A likable coward, but a coward nonetheless. So I admit that impulsiveness is a mixed blessing. You know what a guy like me needs? He needs an anchor for his soul. If you put one of my boats out there into the middle of the sea and a storm comes up and the boat isn't anchored in the right way, the wind and the waves will just push the boat toward the shore and then beat it up against the rocks into 10,000 pieces. Well, I'm like that. I need an anchor. And that's why I followed him. He gave me that kind of mooring. I've been my own leader all my life, and I've made a mess of it more often than not. But in the midst of the wild extremes of my life, Jesus has actually become a stable point. I suppose that you'd say he gives me a kind of peace. Now, I don't mean the kind of peace that you get when you're high up over the hill here above Capernaum, looking down at the sparkling sunshine against the water. No, his presence brought a peace that's more like cleanness than calmness. Sometimes when I saw him heal someone or create a net full of fish when there wasn't any there before, do you know what I would feel? I would feel dirty because I realized that I was at that moment dealing with someone whose power was connected to his perfection. He was so clean and I was so dirty. So when that bratty girl outside the high priest's courtyard asked me if I was one of his disciples, and I said no, my soul felt as though it was full of darkness and anguish. When I said I didn't know Jesus, I really was putting myself at sea in a storm with no moorings. When I traded him for the warmth of that fire, I had thrown overboard the only anchor my soul ever had. I was pretty bitter, had a pretty sad cry that night as I saw the ferocious darkness of my own soul and heart. I felt angry and hurt and stupid all at the same time. A fisherman doesn't throw his anchor overboard in the middle of the storm, but that's exactly what I had done. My boat was headed for the rocks and I knew it. The next day, a pretty flimsy trial was held with trumped-up witnesses and accusations. Peter turned Jesus over to the will of the mob who had been manipulated by the Jewish leaders, and by noon they had run him out of town and they had him gasping for breath on that cross. As I watched from my cowardly distance, I realized something. I realized that Jesus was the one who at that moment was on the rocks. He was the one who had lost his own anchor. He was the one who had given up the moorings of his soul. He screamed out just before he died, my God, why have you forsaken me?" His anchor was gone. I found Andrew and John and the others, and we spent the next couple of days in a stunned stupor, We half-heartedly started making plans to pack up and go back home to Galilee, begin our fishing business again. When the first day of the week came, it was time to pick up the pieces and start fishing. Andrew and I were talking over how we could get our old crew back together again and buy back our old boats. We were just about ready to pack up and start heading toward home when in burst Mary Magdalene. Now my heart ached for her because these last days she was just worn out from all of her mourning, but she was excited and nervous and clearly upset. She said that she'd been out to Jesus' tomb early in the morning, even before the sun came up, to anoint his body with burial spices that she didn't have time to use on Friday because the Sabbath was beginning, and her words spilled out. They've taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have taken him or put him. And I felt that bitter hatred rising again in my gut against the Sanhedrin and the Romans. It wasn't enough for them to kill Jesus. It wasn't enough for them to crucify him because he was a murderer. It wasn't enough for them to take away the only sure anchor Israel ever had. But now they had to steal his body, fearful that we would make off with it. Well, I said I was impulsive, right? Well, I jumped up, running as fast as I could toward the tomb. John must have been pretty impulsive too, because he was running even faster than I was and got there first. And when I arrived a minute or so after him, he was stooping down, peering in the entrance of the tomb. Well, I didn't wait around for anyone to give me a lesson on decorum at tombs. I just went right in. The linen cloth in which he had been hastily wrapped was lying there. I could see the blood on it from the wounds in his hands and feet, and from the centurion's spear in his side. I remember the line from one of the prophets who said that the servant would suffer and be marred and scarred, and that he would not have the kind of appearance that would attract men to him. I was lost for a moment, staring at the blood-stained cloth. I couldn't get out of my mind the picture of the wounds in his hands and side. But then I stopped focusing on the linen cloths and I thought about what wasn't there. He wasn't there. And somewhere between my head and my heart, I remembered his words when he was with us. I turned to John, who had entered the tomb behind me. Do you remember, I asked John, what he had told us? You will all fall away from me. The shepherd will be struck down and the sheep will be scattered. But then he said, but after I have been raised, I will go before you into Galilee. I want to ask you something. Do you think God was tricked out on that garbage dump outside of Jerusalem? Do you think what happened to Jesus was just the tragic consequence of a corrupt religious and political leadership? Look, I'm no elder, no scribe, and I'm certainly no politician, but I want to tell you this. Men did the worst they could do to Jesus, and then God did his best to him. God put an end to the agony of death. It was impossible for Jesus to be held in death's power. All the bitterness and hatred of man was poured out on him. But God gave the power of life where men had produced death. And where there was only the meanness of death, God turned it into a living hope by giving Jesus life from the dead and bringing him out of that tomb. He wasn't there. I tell you, he wasn't there. Do you know what we all have done? We have all thrown our anchors overboard. We're all running our little boats onto the rocks. When Jesus died, not only the anchor of my soul, but the anchor of the whole world was cast into the deepest sea, so far down and deep that it could never be retrieved by humankind. Only God could do it. Only God could bring him back from the dead. Only God could restore the anchor without which the world heads for the rocks of its own destruction, be it by wars or the petty personal grievances that mark our lives. Whatever it is, every one of us is headed toward death. Every one of us is headed toward the rocks of our own destruction. We fool ourselves a lot, you know. We think that the storm will not come to us. We think somehow it will be delayed. We think somehow death will not come. Ah, but some of you know. Some of you know altogether too well. Death steals into the night just at a time you perhaps least expect him. You know how quickly those storms come up. You know how quickly on the sea we can lose control, and without an anchor, our boats head toward the rocks. The agony of death holds its invincible power over every one of us. No one will be spared the death rocks unless he gets an anchor that will hold him back from those rocks, that will prevent the boat from his life crashing upon them. Do you see the rocks? Do you see death out before you? Do you not see its inevitability? You have an anchor. You threw it overboard. But do you know how big and wide and deep is the love of God? When you threw over the only anchor that could save your soul, God retrieved him from the dead. He is not dead. He is alive. He holds your boat from the rocks. The anchor is the rock who saves you from the rocks of death. He holds your life until the storms have passed and you may safely steer to another shore. He commands my boat. He's my captain. He's even more powerful in his living again. He steers me away from the rocks. He is the bleeding galley slave who has become the captain of my soul. And not only of my soul, he's the world's captain. The anchor of my soul is the anchor of the world. Oh, this is a small and fragile earth, and it's heading for the rocks of its own destruction. But the dying servant has become the living captain. The same hands which nails stabbed now hold the tiller of this poor world. The ugly wounds of suffering are now the handsome tokens of his leadership. He shall ever be the captain of the universe, and at the steps of his pierced feet and the nod of his bloodied brow, all the storms shall forever cease, and the greedy rocks shall dash to death their prey no more. I told you before, I find it amusing that my name is Peter, the Rock. Well, as a sailor and a fisherman, I've always been wary of the rocks. But now I see the twist in Jesus' meaning. Left to myself, I either sink like a rock or I'll crash my life onto the jagged rocks which endanger us all. But here's the twist. Jesus named me Rock because my declaration of faith in him is a rock. My confession that I believe in him becomes the rock of my life. I'm impulsive, unreliable, dangerous, like the rocks on the seacoast. But Jesus makes my trust of him the rock upon which he will build. And he wants the same declaration out of you, my friends. All of you gathered in this cozy tavern this morning, he wants you to know that your life's will surely end on the rocks of death, or they will be given over to his saving power. One or the other. One or the other. Either the rock of death or the rock of Christ. I remember that he told me that the rock of my declaration of faith in him, that upon that rock he would build something he called the church. Well, I don't know much about what that church is. I'm not sure I understand it. But I do know that he said the gates of hell will never prevail and overcome it. And that part I understand. Because you see, whatever he leads will be led to victory. He's the captain of my boat. He steers it away from hell's destruction. The jagged rocks of death crushed him, but God made him to be the anchor and the captain, ever to live and ever to help all of us who place our trust in him, who put our lives in his nail-marked hands, who build our lives upon the rock of faith, that Christ is not dead, but he's alive by the power of God. And with him too, I will be saved from destruction and death. So I greet you this morning, my fellow sailors. Fair sailing to you all, every one of you. But him I salute with other words. All hail my captain, my living captain, for you have guided me away from the gates of hell to the safety of a better shore where fear and death are gone forever. All hail! All hail, my captain! Hail!